State of the Bay. I'm your host, Grace Wan. Later on the show tonight, we're going to be sitting down with San Francisco Unified School District Superintendent Dr. Maria Su. Teachers, parents, students, if you have questions for the superintendent, we certainly want to hear from you. You can email your questions now to stateofthebay@kalw.org. Later in the hour, you can call us at 866-798-8255. Also, at the end of the hour, we're going to hear about a new fad. It's called transit speedrunning, and we'll meet the speedrunners who set a record by hitting all 50 BART stations in just 5 hours. I guess that's what qualifies as fun these days. But first, last week, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, or CDCR, announced that the planned transformation of San Quentin into a Nordic-style rehabilitation center would be complete in January of 2026. It will cost $236 million, and the revamped San Quentin will become the flagship of what is being dubbed the new California model of prisons. Here to discuss why this is happening and why now is Daryl Steinberg. He's the former mayor of San Francisco, a former California state senator, and the lead advisor on Governor Newsom's San Quentin Advisory Council. Daryl Steinberg, welcome to State of the Bay, and thank you so much for being here.
Good to be with you, Grace. Yes, I was mayor of Sacramento.
Oh, Sacramento. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. I love San Francisco, too.
Go Giants. I mean, yeah. It's all of a piece. We love Sacramento here. But thank you for that correction.
I love it.
The San Quentin Advisory Council, which you lead, issued a report recommending that the prison incorporate some aspect of the Norwegian model into its own prison. First of all, can you explain what the Norwegian model is?
The Norwegian model is a philosophy of corrections that focuses on public safety and also focuses intensively on the rehabilitation of everybody who serves their time. Their correctional facilities tend to be smaller. They tend to be much more personalized in terms of every resident having a plan for what they are going to do once they are released. The correctional officers themselves are trained not just in security, but what is called dynamic security, where they also learn how to relate to the residents, the people that they are supervising, so that they are actual participants in some ways in the rehabilitation of people. And what, of course, the end result is that the recidivism rate in European countries like Norway is significantly less than the recidivism rate in the United States. I mean, in California, the recidivism rate is almost 50%. In Norway, it's 25%. And so it makes a point, if I may, Grace, which is that when people hear about the San Quentin Initiative, they say, oh, this is just coddling, or this is against what people want to get tougher on crime. Well, this is about public safety. I mean, if we can help people have better lives once they leave, 90% of the people leave. And if they don't recommit, that's good for public safety. And it also shows more humanity for people who are trying to integrate back into society.
You know, I'm curious because, you know, Norway is a very different country in a lot of ways to the United States, and maybe perhaps more homogenous in terms of population. It's got more social safety nets available. You know, tell me how the prison population of California compares to Norway, and what makes you think that these types of recommendations, these changes, will work here?
Well, it's not an exact a match. And I think that's clear. The California model is based on the principles of Norway, but it's not exactly the Norway model for the reasons your question indicates. The prison population is still large in California, larger than the Norway population. That's one significant difference. And so the other thing is California has a range of prisons. For example, the rehabilitation model that we are working on at San Quentin is for so-called level two prisons. In other words, those places where the residents themselves have shown that they are willing to engage in rehabilitation and do not have indicators showing that they are prone to violence. This won't apply to every single prison in California, whereas in Norway, while they have some maximum security prisons, the entire system is really based on this rehabilitation model. But we're starting, you know, the governor's view, I think, and certainly my view, is that every journey begins with a large step. And San Quentin is a perfect place to do this. You've got good, great leadership, a great warden. You have a dedicated staff, and you have a cadre of volunteers that have already made San Quentin a place that is halfway there, but it's overcrowded. The cells are not the way we want people to live who are trying to engage in rehabilitation. At a minimum, we want to make sure that we end double selling so that everybody's got their own space, which is necessary if you're going to rehabilitate. The physical plant is still an old style prison. And so the project that's going to finish in January of 2026 is actually taking down an old prison industry manufacturing facility and making it into a state of the art like community college that is going to be the center of education, the center of workforce training for these residents. San Quentin, again, already has some incredible model programs. Its whole media center, for example, is renowned throughout the Bay Area and much of the country. But this is going to allow the leadership here to show how the California model can work, that we can do better than a nearly 50% recidivism rate.
And how does that compare to, you know, I think people don't know a little bit about prisons, but don't know a lot about prisons. And, you know, there's the state system and there's the federal system. And we often hear about minimum security federal prisons, which, you know, have been called Club Fed. How does this compare to something like that? I mean, are the incarcerated individuals getting an education? Are they just getting nicer facilities and better food? I mean, what is exactly happening?
Well, again, this is going to be work in progress. Mm-hmm. There still will be security because that comes first. And only when we call them residents, because these are human beings, so that they can safely re-enter society even before they are released on parole into reentry program to begin meeting with family members, to begin working out in the community. Only when they show they are ready can they leave the facility. The idea is to create a place that is more humane, a place that that holds, again, people accountable for what they have done. They're still be locked in. But to normalize the environment as much as possible to make it like what life will be when they are released back into the community. Mm-hmm. Because if we don't do that, you know, like some of the things we're talking about in our implementation report, like have certain occasions where the residents can wear normal clothing. How about bringing in fresh food and having the residents be part of manufacturing and not just serving but making the healthy food at the facility? Create a town square where residents and correctional officers can interact together as part of the rehabilitation process. You know, it's one of the understated parts of this whole project is that the correctional officers themselves suffer. I mean, the rates of suicide, the rates of depression are way too high. And in part because when your job is to do nothing but oversee somebody in a harsh way, that is wearing on the soul of the person who has to do that. We want the correctional officers, yes, to put safety and security first, but to also feel like their job is helping somebody reclaim their place in society in the right way.
I assume that not everybody, you know, signed on to this idea from the outset, and that you had some work to do to kind of explain it to people and maybe, quote unquote, sell it to people. I'm curious, you know, for the California Correctional Police Officers and their union, are they receptive to this program, and what's the reaction?
They have been very receptive to this. In fact, one of their lead officers was an integral part of the task force work. And yes, because they see it as something that will improve the job satisfaction for their members, where they see a job currently that can be very oppressive. They want their members to be able to participate in something that is more positive. Now, none of this happens overnight. And this is why starting at San Quentin, you know, someone say, why aren't you doing this everywhere? Well, resource-wise and otherwise, you have to start someplace and prove a concept. And then when it works, you have the ability then to spread it to other prisons where it is appropriate. Again, these level two prisons where the security is still high, but not as high as for the people who, you know, are not ready for this and whose histories say they shouldn't be doing this. Although one of the things that's, again, interesting about this is some of the people who are most likely to rehabilitate are the lifers, are people who are serving life sentences. These are mostly young, you know, were young men who committed, you know, bad acts when they were in their teens and their 20s. But now they're in their 40s and 50s. And whatever that thing was, you know, that male thing, mostly, that led them to commit the violent crime. They're different people. And they're often the mentors, actually, in the facility. And that's quite inspiring.
You know, it's a different time. I mean, a tricky time these days. And certainly the election showed, even in California, kind of a move towards the center to the right when it comes to law and order policies. You know, voters voting to make it harder, make it more difficult to commit crimes, et cetera. Does this feel out of step with how voters are feeling? And if it's not, why isn't it?
It's not out of step. And I would argue that strongly with anybody, because 90% of the people who go to prison leave prison. They leave. So the question is, when they leave, are they going to be prepared for life on the outside? And if they are not, they are more likely to recommit because they have no skills. They haven't dealt with their trauma, whatever led them to crime in the first place. And so from a public safety perspective, what we're doing at San Quentin and what the governor is leading here at San Quentin is consistent with public safety. And so we have to always, you know, I think the public safety debate, frankly, is always so emotional. And sometimes understandably, I mean, certainly with victims and victims groups, I understand that.
Yeah.
But I think we always have to do the right thing and the smart thing that says no human being should be forsaken, number one. And number two, public safety always comes first. And I think this initiative combines the two.
Well, I mean, certainly it sounds like an amazing program, and you can read more about it. The report from the San Quentin Advisory Council is available on the KALW State of the Bay webpage, and we're going to have to leave it there. Daryl Steinberg, former mayor of Sacramento and lead advisor of the San Quentin Advisory Council, thanks so much for joining us.
I enjoyed it, Chris. Thank you.
Yeah. Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll sit down with San Francisco Unified School District Superintendent Dr. Maria Su. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Hanat Baba, host of Cross Currents. If you hear the news, you know public media and independent journalism are under threat. But here at KALW, we also want you to know that we are standing strong. Starting April 8th, we're inviting you to stand with us to support journalism that pushes back against misinformation. The reality is we can't do it alone. So join us. April 8th, invest in KALW Public Media. And let's grow this thing together.
Tune in to Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. An East Bay farmer is working to plant seeds for a brighter future.
Having a childhood is the priority. We cannot expect kids to be, you know, forward thinking or future thinking or make good decisions when they are boxed in.
A visit to an Oakland urban farm. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm your host, Grace Wan. It's been a tumultuous few years for the San Francisco Unified School District, from school board recalls to a payroll system meltdown, and last fall, chaos surrounding potential school closures that ultimately led to Matt Wayne, the then superintendent, to step down. In his place, the Board of Education appointed Dr. Maria Sue, a longtime city official who most recently led the Department of Children, Youth, and Their Families. Dr. Sue has been in this job for almost 6 months, and we're happy to have her here tonight. Welcome to State of the Bay, Dr. Sue.
Hi, Grace. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, delighted that you could join us. And before we begin, listeners, this is your chance to speak to Dr. Sue directly. Are you a parent, teacher, student? Do you feel like things are back on track for San Francisco Public Schools? Or are there programs or staff positions you want to make sure aren't on the chopping block? Or just, do you just have some questions? We're taking emails now at stateofthebay@kalw.org, or you can reach us by calling us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Give us a call now. So Dr. Sue, welcome. And it's probably fair to say that things were chaotic a little bit when you took over the reins. Tell us what those first weeks were like for you and what you were focused on.
Chaotic might be an understatement there. But I do want to just start by saying that I am very grateful for the opportunity that our school board gave me to become the current superintendent for SFUSD. I am a former SFUSD parent and longtime public servant in San Francisco. And as a parent, I know that we all want to deeply invest in our school district, in our children's education, and to make sure that we are doing the best for our children on day one of them stepping into the classroom. And that is what I take with me in this job. Over the last 6 months, I have been able to visit many, many classrooms across our entire district, where I've learned with fourth graders in their math class. I've actually judged a spelling bee in one of our schools, I know. I participated in science fairs. I've seen our amazing high school students debating on what is our political state at this moment in time. And I've had the pleasure of watching our fantastic middle schoolers perform at Brava Theater. Needless to say, our students are magical and our educators are even better.
Well,
fantastic people here.
Yeah. Tell me, you know, you mentioned that you were a parent in the school district. Where did your kids go to school?
I have two boys. I live out in the Ingleside Terrace area. So my kids went to Commodore Sloat, which is an elementary school, and then to Aptus Middle School. And then for high school, we chose a different route.
Oh, great. And do you have fond memories of that experience as a parent, or were there frustrations even at the time for you?
Oh, my goodness. So I loved our elementary school, Commodore Sloat. It was a cute little neighborhood school that our children build really, really wonderful, long-lasting friendships. Actually, my son just had a play date with one of his kids. My son now, who's 16, just had a play date with one of his friends that he
might not want you to call it a play date, Dr. Sue.
Oh, my goodness. You're right. See, once a mom, always a mom.
Always a mom. I know. I know.
But these are the relationships that our children build in wonderful, safe places, right?
Yeah.
We still remember fondly the wonderful teachers there at our elementary school. Once again, just the experiences of the care that our teachers provided us and the trust that my kids had when they went to school. They knew that they were going to be in a place where they were going to learn, We knew that they were going to learn, and they were thriving.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the budget deficit. The district is facing a significant budget deficit and needs to cut around, I think, $113 million to remain fiscally solvent and avoid a state takeover. Tell us what you're doing now to make sure that the district stays in local hands.
Yeah, we actually have a really, really tough time right now. We have to make really tough decisions. We have a $1.2 billion budget, 85% of which pays for our employees. So making a $113.8 million reduction is very, very painful. So what I've shared is that in order for us to get there, we have to evaluate all of our contracts to make sure that the ones who are not working, we have to end. The ones that were just good to have, we have to end. We're only keeping contracts that are essential to helping us meet our student outcomes. And then number two, we have to unfortunately separate with our staff. There are two strategies that we are getting there. One is offer a supplemental early retirement package. And then the other one, of course, last resort is layoffs.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Did you want to add on to that?
Well, and then our third strategy is to evaluate how we do the work of the district. How are we being more efficient and maximizing the operations within the district?
Mm-hmm. I mean, when you talk about what contracts are essential and what contracts are nice to have, can you kind of explain what's in the essential bucket and what's in the nice to have bucket?
So we have a lot of consultants that we use to provide supports to our district. And unfortunately, we might not be able to continue with those large consulting contracts. But the essential ones are all of the ones for our special education programs and services. We need to have those contracts. We need to have our nurses. So these are programs and contracts that we need to have. And those are essential for us to continue to do the work of supporting our students so that they can learn and thrive.
Mm. And, you know, regarding one way that was discussed in the previous administration to help close the budget gap was to close certain schools. Are school closures going to go back on the table?
You know, before we talk about school closures, I want everyone to understand that the enrollment decline is that we're seeing in San Francisco is actually seen nationwide. You know, my mom was one of 8 children in her family. My dad was one of 10 children in his family. And now I only have 2 children in my family. So it is a phenomenon that we're seeing across the country. We're feeling it a lot in San Francisco. And so what we need to do is really evaluate how we're best utilizing all of our school buildings. What I am really happy to say is that for this coming school year, we received over 700 transitional kindergarten applications than expected, and over 150 kindergarten applications than expected. We have this wonderful situation of trying to build out all of different classrooms to meet the needs and the demand. So before we have the conversation about school closures, we need to really evaluate all of the facilities that we have now and how we are best utilizing them to meet the needs of our schools.
Well, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm your host, Grace Wan, and we're sitting down tonight with Dr. Maria Sue. She's the superintendent of the San Francisco Unified School District, and we're taking your calls and questions. Do you have questions about how the district plans to address its budget deficit, or are you a student or a parent or a teacher within the district, and do you have a question for Dr. Sue? You can give us a call now at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, or you can email us us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And we have an email from Rick in Citrus Heights. He says, I hope that part of the Superintendent Sue's plans are to address homelessness amongst minors who are still in school, as well as homelessness amongst students in SFUSD who have with disabilities. Is homelessness a problem that is on your radar screen and top of mind?
Yes, unfortunately, we do see a lot of our students who are homeless and underhoused. We are working very closely with our city partners to find solutions for our families for that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the enrollment that you saw in applications. There's 10% increase in applications, highest in over a decade. What do you account for that in terms of like people coming to the district and wanting to enroll their kids?
Well, we're really excited about the increase in our transitional kindergarteners. Mm-hmm. So it's really turning San Francisco Unified School District to start at TK instead of kindergarten. So that is wonderful. We also know that we're getting some really great outcomes in our high school students and middle school students. You know, just last week, we saw the results of our social, emotional, and culture surveys that we sent out to all of our students. And we're seeing that 73% of our elementary school students felt that they had a caring adult at school, felt that they belonged in their school, felt that they could be successful in their school. And get this, 80% of our middle and high schoolers felt the same way. We are turning a corner. Right now, even though it doesn't feel as robust as normal, we are seeing some really great results in our high school students. We are seeing that our high school students have the highest number of students ready for UC schools than any other county across the state. So we are doing something right. Mm-hmm. We are supporting our students, and parents are hearing that and seeing that. They want their students to be a part of the school district so that their students can also be a part of this magic that is happening at SFUSD.
You know, you're talking about the magic at SFUSD, and I interviewed Dr. Matt Wayne, I think twice when he was in the job. And, you know, at the time, a teacher called in and kind of explained that their salary was sort of stayed at $68,000 and they had been a teacher for over 10 years. Do you think that teachers are getting paid enough? And what are you doing to make sure that they get paid a living wage?
I've definitely agree that cost of living in San Francisco is really, really high. It's very difficult for a family to make ends meet here. We are really proud at SFUSD that we were able to increase our teacher salaries over the past several years. And we continue to support our teachers by just recently saying that we were not going to lay off any of our teachers as part of this budget strategy. We wanted to make sure that we continue to have teachers in all of our classrooms to support our students so that they can have the education that they need and deserve.
Mm. Well, what's the average tenure of a teacher in the San Francisco Unified School District?
That depends on a lot of different factors. I'll have to get back to you on some more data.
And well, what's the average? If I've been a teacher now for 10 years in the district, what's my average salary?
Maybe around 180.
If I'm a teacher,
$80,000 to $100,000.
Oh, $80,000 to $100,000. You had me quite surprised there. I thought it was $180,000. I thought, wow, that's not so bad. So that's the average salary that a teacher with 10 years of tenure would be making. Is that enough?
You know, that's no. As a person who lives here and who's trying to raise my children here, I know that that's a really tough salary to raise children on.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another email. John from San Francisco writes, SFUSD plans to stabilize its $1.2 billion budget by cutting $113 million. But with 70% of the funding tied to enrollment, is this enough? The district's lack of focus on ADA, rising expenses, and other fiscal factors raises concerns about long-term stability. I mean, I think what John is getting at is, I mean, are you going to be having to do this every year, cutting $100 millions from the budget?
Well, we actually are fortunate that we have something called a fiscal stabilization plan. It's a multi-year budgeting strategy that, quite frankly, is required by the state. And so in this budgeting strategy, this plan, it states that for next year, fiscal year 25-26, we have to cut the $113.8 million. And then for fiscal year 26-27, we're going to be cutting an additional $13 million. Hmm. That's because, once again, 85% of our budget is comprised of staff. So if we make the deep cuts now, then the expenses won't continue to grow in the out years.
Well, we're sitting down tonight here at KLW in the State of the Bay with Dr. Maria Su. She's the superintendent of the San Francisco Unified School District. If you have a question for Dr. Su, now's your chance to ask her. The number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can send us an email at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Or you can find us on socials. We're also at State of the Bay. You know, right now we're in a tricky time with the Trump administration. The administration's recent move to slash more than half or to actually close down the Department of Education has sparked a national concern. How are those cuts, how is what's happening at the federal level affecting San Francisco?
Well, first of all, I guess we're fortunate that only 5% of our budget comes from the federal government. 70% of our budget comes from the state, and then 25% of our budget comes from the city of San Francisco. So we are very, very grateful to our very generous citizens and residents here in San Francisco who have supported our school district for over the years, for many years. But in terms of the cuts to from the federal government to us, the majority of those cuts are going to the majority of the funds from the federal government to us comes through our special education programs, as well as our programs to support our focal students. So we are working very closely with our California Department of Education leaders there to figure out how we can fight back to make sure that our federal government understands that there will be irreparable harm if they were to cut these budgets from us. And quite frankly, to force us to conform to any additional rhetorics that they're asking right now.
Hmm. Can I ask how the district is protecting certain categories of students? Early on, when the Trump administration announced mass raids, there was a rumor that was flying around the district that some students had been targeted. That didn't turn out to be correct, but what are schools doing to protect immigrant students? Let's start with that.
Well, first, we are really, really fortunate that San Francisco is a sanctuary city and that SFUSD is a sanctuary school district inside that city. We have established a really strong working relationship with our city attorney, who has helped us on a number of occasions already regarding dealing with the federal administration. Every student in our district has a right to attend our schools regardless of immigration status and regardless of their family's immigration status. We have many rules and laws and policies that's from the state as well as our Board of Education that dictates the freedom that our students have to an education. And we continue to uphold those laws and board policies to make sure that we provide and create an inclusive environment for all of our students. As a matter of fact, just a few months ago, we successfully launched the Queer and Transgender Parent Advisory Council in the district to say that we support our queer and transgendered students, as well as their, as well as our staff. I am ready to, we're going to celebrate Pride this April, all of April. It's going to be Pride Month for us, primarily because our, you know, the city celebrates Pride during June, but that's when our students are not in school. So we're celebrating Pride in April, and we've been doing this for the past 30 years. I have no desire to change, not to change that. We will continue to support all of our students so that they have access to the quality education I know that they deserve.
We have a different question. The San Francisco Chronicle recently reported on a district policy that limits a school's PTA from using its own funds to pay for extra staff like support teachers or tutors. And I mean, the report is that many parents are frustrated by that. Educators are as well, given how tight the district's budget is right now. Why implement a policy like that at a time when schools are stretched thin and parents are willing to pitch in?
Yeah, so I just first want to say that I am so grateful to all the parents who contribute not only just their time, but their resources to our schools. Our schools are so lucky that we have such caring parents and guardians in all of our schools. In relations to this particular policy that that I implemented, it was primarily to say to our PTA colleagues, to allow the schools to hire a teacher first. And what that means is that when I came into the district 6 months ago, I realized that the only way for us to get to the goal of our third grade literacy rates, our eighth grade math, as well as having students graduate college and career ready, is for us to have a qualified teacher in every single one of our classrooms. Unfortunately, as of today, we are still looking at 98 classrooms that do not have a qualified teacher in it. We need to hire more teachers. Unfortunately, there's a teacher shortage throughout the state. And so all I'm asking is for schools to allow the district to hire teachers first. And once we fill these classrooms up, then schools will then be allowed and to hire additional teachers for their school sites.
I think it's a little bit confusing because on the one hand, the district has a significant deficit and has announced layoffs, but then rolled that back. And now you're saying to parents, well, don't hire anybody with your funds until we hire somebody ourselves. It feels like a kind of a Gordian knot a little bit. So if the district doesn't have enough money to fulfill these contracts and won't be able to fill those spots, why not use some of this PTA money?
Well, once again, our PTAs are wonderful and they can use their funds to hire a number of positions to support their schools. They can use the funds to pay for assistant principals, for counselors, for social workers, for instructional aides. What I'm asking for is to allow the district to hire teachers to serve the entire district instead of just one school. Mm. I am looking at this at district-wide. We have over 125 schools that we need to make sure have a qualified teacher in every single classroom.
Hmm. Well, an email from Cynthia, she writes, SFUSD faces some really terrifying budget cuts. The reasons are numerous, but it's the kids who suffer and, as elsewhere, have to beg for computers and even Band-Aids. One of our public school gems is School of the Arts, and it's produced artists like Margaret Cho and Sam Rockwell. We want more of them, right?
Yes.
It doesn't sound like you're a person who wants to close down schools or you're in favor of just more and more in abundance, but you're dealing with with the reality, which is limited funds, right? So when you hear about people wanting this and that, how do you address that? You know, when everybody has their pet peeve or their pet project, what's your message back?
Well, I think that there is an opportunity for us to really think strategically about how do we do more And how do we continue to support our students? With the reduction that I'm talking about, with the $113.8 million in reduction, it represents 10% of our budget. There's still 90% of our budget remaining. And that allows us to really radically reimagine what we do in our district to support our students. So yes, I do feel that we need to ensure that our students have access to arts. Actually, last week, I just went to see the new exhibit at the SF MoMA for the Ruth Asawa art display. There are so many different ways to integrate art and music and dance and theater into our programs. I think building stronger partnership with our schools and with our city, and quite frankly, with the philanthropic community is going to be key.
Mm. Well, the mayor has really little to no control over what happens in the school districts. But what kind of conversations are you having with Mayor Lurie? I mean, he's really leaned on philanthropy to help with the situation with, for example, unhoused people. Is that something that you're talking to Mayor Lurie about for the school district? I mean, his kids are not in the school district, but...
Oh, but Mayor Lurie is 100% supportive of SFUSD and wants us to succeed as much as all of our parents in our district wants us to succeed. He has actually been a fantastic partner with us, so much so that we are working very closely with all of his senior advisors to make sure that we find opportunities to support our students, both on a policy level, like housing and homelessness, as well as helping us to fundraise or to get the word out about how wonderful our programs are. So they have been a fantastic partner to us.
Mm-hmm. So you want to support fundraising around other things other than getting teachers, is that right?
Well, we need to fundraise for a lot of different things. The teacher situation, once again, is because we have a nationwide teacher shortage. Mm-hmm. And so we do not have enough teachers to hire. And once again, all I want to do is make sure that the district hires teachers into our classrooms so that all of our classrooms will have a qualified teacher in it in order for us to meet those big outcomes and goals of academic excellence that we want our students to have.
Well, there's so much more to cover, and certainly you are a passionate advocate for our schools and a former parent as well. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for tonight, but Dr. Maria Su, Superintendent of the San Francisco Unified School District, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. And then just in closing, if families want to continue this conversation with me, I am hosting a number of town halls and community engagements throughout the city. So for families, please go onto our website. That's www.sfusd.edu to learn more about it.
Well, I suggest that people go, and Dr. Su is willing to talk to you. Thank you again, Dr. Su. And coming up after the break, we'll hear from Fred Pitts and his interview with two speedrunners. Stay tuned.
Join us for Your Legal Rights Wednesday evenings at 6. Host Jeff Hayden and guests cover a wide variety of legal topics and issues, from tax tips to landlord-tenant issues, discrimination and workers' rights on the job, as well as broader constitutional issues. That's Your Legal Rights every Wednesday evening at 6, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area, and online at kalw.org.
Hi, I'm Hanat Baba, host of Cross Currents. If you hear the news, you know public media and independent journalism are under threat. But here at KALW, we also want you to know that we are standing strong. Starting April 8th, we're inviting you to stand with us to support journalism that pushes back against misinformation. The reality is we can't do it alone. So join us. April 8th, invest in KALW Public Media. And let's grow this thing together.
Pumping life and energy into public transportation, there is an unusual sport out there called speed running, which, if you've never heard of it, involves hitting every station in a public transportation system in a metropolitan area, which sounds impossible to me, but it's not impossible. Tonight, we've got two Bay Area residents who have set the record for speed running on BART. I'd like to welcome Enzo Wu and Adam from the YouTube website Adam Does Not Exist to our show. Adam, Enzo, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Let's talk about this concept of speed running. I know it isn't new. It started a long time ago. Enzo, can you tell us some background on what speed running is or where it started?
So speed running in general actually isn't a general term at all. It came up from gaming communities where the goal was to try to complete something as fast as possible. And this can be seen in basically any game nowadays. In the context of transit speedruns, it started in the London Tube, which is a very old challenge by now.
Well, how long has the tube run challenge been going on, do you know?
Not exactly, but there is a Wikipedia page set up just for the tube challenge.
I think Alicia has it on the BART website. It started in 1960,
okay.
I believe.
That's been a while. So how did it get started in the Bay Area?
Long time ago, a decade ago or longer even.
So when we did our run, I got an email from the first person who ever did it, Jim Wu. I believe it was 2012 or 2014.
Okay.
Back when there were only 44 BART stations. And he did it in a time of, it was around 5.5 hours.
Okay.
Sort of had a resurgence lately, but that's when it started.
So I guess it was October of last year, you two partnered up and you broke the record for speed running for BART, which was what, 5 hours, 9 minutes, and 35 seconds. Am I correct?
Yes.
How did you two meet and hook up?
You want to do this one?
I feel like I should tell this story.
Okay.
This story is so good. So I was making videos about the Bay Area, some of the cool stuff going on. And I found this video from Toma Tawalinya on YouTube. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I want to try that. It was speedrunning BART. And then I made this video and the top comment by far was Enzo's. And it was just like 3 paragraphs of, here are things you did wrong. This is stuff you could have done differently.
Informational comment.
I was in disbelief because he's just like, who is this person? And fast forward, he emails me and he's like, hey, you know, if you ever want to chat about this, happy to get on the phone. And after like 2 hours on the phone, Enzo breaks it to me that he's 15 years old and has an even faster route than the one that's the current world record.
Wow.
And he was just casually like, you know, I might try this someday and you're welcome to tag along. That's how it all began.
Brilliant. What was the prior speedrunning record for BART?
Prior to our run?
Yes.
It was actually, I believe, my record with Tomo Tawalinya, or I think they go by Tonsi now. And it was 5 hours, 30 minutes, and 26 seconds.
Okay.
Which was also a new revolutionary route. So
interesting. So the idea is you have to hit all 50 BART stations. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Tell us how you came up with the process of doing that. What was your plan?
When I completed the 5 hour, 30 minute, 26 second run with Tonsi, it was already general consensus within the Tiny community at the time that that would be the unbeatable world record because the route was exceptionally optimized already. And there were many components that were already extremely difficult to even get after 4 or 5 attempts. And, you know, each attempt takes a really long time. So it's really hard to plan out. I just thought I want to push it because why not? Eventually, I got to the point where I just opened up a new spreadsheet and just started inputting whatever values, any route I could possibly come up with. Because once you reach a certain point, it's not that any route is wrong or stupid until you actually try it and break it down. Honestly, the route that I came up with that got us the 5:09 world record is quite out there, I would say.
Out there? What do you mean out there?
Yeah, so it actually involves taking Caltrain, which is a completely separate service, of course, in the Bay Area and has nothing to do with BART. And we kept the earlier components the same. So we kept the OAK transfer because the OAK window to take a Coliseum connector train, Coliseum to the Oakland airport is 18 minutes round trip to go from Coliseum back to Coliseum. And if you're familiar with BART, all of its lines run 20 minute headways. And so if you do the math, 20 minus 17, well, you have 3 minutes or 2 minutes spare. That 2 minutes, if you time it perfectly, is just enough time to get between the Coliseum BART platform and the Coliseum People Mover platform that brings you to OAK. That challenge was really hard, but we had to conquer it anyways for the 5:30:26 run. And then beyond that, there was the Caltrain component, which actually involved a very difficult transfer at Powell Street Station, where you had to run or take a bike down to 4th and King Caltrain.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. He's being modest. This is Enzo's thing. He's so modest. When he says out there, he means it's basically impossible. You have to have so many things line up perfectly for it to like even have a chance.
Oh, yeah.
We at took, making like, what, these transfers. Yeah. I mean, we were lucky to get it in four. The transfer to Caltrain he's talking about involves sprinting out of the Powell Street BART station, running up the stairs, hoping that there's bikes available, riding them down to the Bayshore stations down by Caltrain, getting on Caltrain, getting off. It's out there is one way to put it, but like basically impossible is maybe another.
Well, just the idea of getting out of Powell Street station, running up the stairs and trying to get out without running into somebody is a challenge.
Pretty hard. Yeah. All now, the stairs.
I did a little bit of looking into the idea of the Guinness Book of World Records. And there's this whole list of, I won't call them qualifications, but I will call them steps that you have to go through to have this verified as a record, which is something about having something videotaped or maybe not, or having a witness at a certain couple of places. How did you all put that together?
So it is difficult. There's a lot that goes into it. You have to have an official timekeeper. And for us, that was Enzo's dad. We show him in that video as well, but Enzo's dad's there right at the beginning of every single time we try this, and he's there at the end as well. So that's one piece. You have to take a picture at every single station showing the station and the time. There's a ton of rules that you have to follow. And
really inconvenient.
Yeah.
Adam, I have a question for you. You've got your own website, Adam Does Not Exist, which I've been to, and it's really interesting. And you're kind of an influencer on public transportation. What got you excited about amplifying public transport?
I don't really set out to promote public transport. I'm just trying to see what you can do with it. I grew up in a place where there was no transport whatsoever. And when I moved to the Bay Area, it was just like this natural thing that you could do. You got access to so much more without having to find parking or know where you're going. I also set out to tell some stories about the Bay Area that were positive rather than negative. And it felt like a few years ago, the only story you would hear were just these like sad doom loop. So I think for people like us that live here, there's a lot more you can talk about. I think the first time I ever took a train was into Penn Station and went upstairs to watch Wayne Gretzky score a hat trick in the playoffs. Wow. And if that's the first time you take a train, I mean, you're done. You're going to love trains. And yeah, the more I put them transit and trains in my videos, the more I saw a response. So I love doing it and it seems like a lot of people love watching it.
It's a very entertaining website. Do you have a favorite public transportation run?
I still think the video Enzo and I made on this speed run is the best video I've ever made. I have a bunch that are more popular, but I don't think there's any that tell as interesting a story or show it in the way that we did.
Wow. So Enzo, we know you're 15. How did you decide this is going to be your thing?
Well, I would argue that transit has only been a thing in my life for only like 2 years. You know, it was first 2 years ago when I was in eighth grade and my parents were both unavailable to pick me up and send me to school. And so there was actually a perfect plan to solve that. And that was to sign me up for the 511 bus pass, which basically grants free rides to all school children on all bus systems in their respective counties. In my mind, transit wasn't exactly this glamorous thing, but it was quite an inconvenience, I would say, back then. But I grew to love it. And of course, here I am.
Were there things you all did while you were waiting for the next train to come?
People ask me that a lot. Like, you're just sitting on trains. What do you do? And there's sort of two things. When you're doing a speed run, you're just so amped up and excited and trying to figure out if you're going to make the next transfer that you don't have a lot of downtime. You're not bored at any point. And this San Francisco to LA, there's so much to see just looking out the window at California landscapes. And I'm trying to film it. Everywhere you look is another beautiful shot. So it's mostly look out the window, figure out what connections you've got to make next, and just enjoy what you're doing.
I mean, I think it's definitely more fun when you're doing SF to LA, though, because, you know, all the scenery is new.
That's fair. You've mentioned a lot of people when we've been discussing speed running. What is the community like, and is it getting larger?
The community is growing a lot. the creation of the Bay Area Transit Discord server is definitely the main feeder into all of this transit activity recently. It's a very welcoming community where all these transit enthusiasts come together and chat about various topics.
Wow.
Well, we could talk to you all for hours about this, but I think we're out of time. It's been a delight to have you on the show tonight. If you out there listening are interested in the record-breaking run on BART, the BART website has a section on speed runs and also has the video that Adam and Enzo put together when they broke the speedrunning record. In addition, if you want to see any of Adam's videos, especially the one of his trip from San Francisco to LA, go to his YouTube channel, which is www.youtube.com/@AdamDoesNotExist. Adam, Enzo, thank you for joining State of the Bay.
It's a pleasure.
Well, thank you for having us.
That's State of the Bay this week. Let's hear it for transportation. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen and never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit our page. It's on the KALW.org page. And if you have any questions about what you heard, email us at stateofthebay@KALW.org. We're always looking for story ideas, so pitch one of yours to us. Tonight's show is produced by Wendy Holcomb, Chris Nooney, and Heather Hughes. It was engineered by David Kwan, and the fabulous D Minor was our board operator. A replay of this morning's Your Call is next. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.